Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPod and MP3 player. Hey, Tosin, how's it going?
It's going pretty well. Yourself?
I'm good. I just got a new dog.
His name? What?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. His name is Chop.
Chop?
Yeah, yeah. I think he's a pit bull. I'm always having to clean up after his poop and take him for walks where he goes around and defends his bitch from other dogs. And
his bitch.
His bitch is a little poodle, and then snatches bikinis off of girls on the beach.
Wait! Is this a real dog or is this something else?
Chop.
Is it a Tamagotchi?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, kind of is. Chop is my dog in GTA 5.
Wow.
Yeah. And wow. And we're going to talk about that and a whole bunch of other stuff in this week's episode of The Drill Down.
Scary.
Hello and welcome to The Drill Down, the podcast where we take a look at some of the week's most important events in tech and on the web, and how they affect us all. I'm Andy Cercini.
I'm Dwayne DeFreitas.
And I'm Tosin Unofawakin.
This week, GTA 5 breaks entertainment history records. Touch ID is hacked after a week. New devices from Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon. Valve software wants to change gaming from the operating system up. And more. As always, you can check out past episodes of The Drill Down, as well as the other fine shows in the Geeks of Doom podcast network on geeksofdoom.com. Subscribe to us on iTunes. You can go to geeksofdoom.com, and our iTunes subscription link is in the right-hand rail. And join us on facebook.com and twitter.com at The Drill Down. Our show is also on Stitcher at stitcher.com, and search for The Drill Down there. Before we get into headlines, we occasionally like to do a segment on the show we call What We're Playing With, where we talk about the gadgets, apps, and tech that has obsessed us over the last week. And as you've heard in that cold open there, I've spent just about every non-working, non-podcasting hour on GTA 5. And it's interesting, GTA 5...
How does your family feel about that?
Well, they're usually asleep by... You know, there's my working, my daddy duties, some TV I have to catch up with, including the new Marvel Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. show. Outside of that, it's GTA 5. So I'm at like 13% completion of the game so far, which admittedly isn't much. But I feel like I'm fully sort of invested in that world now. I've explored.
When did you receive the game?
Last Tuesday.
13% in a week isn't bad for a man who's living and parenting and all those things. No kidding. Isn't the world in GTA 5 bigger than the planet Earth?
No, just about. It's one for one, oddly enough. No, I wish it was. It's bigger than I think it's bigger than any other previous GTA game, and it's nearly bigger than any other video game world, period. There are a few other video game worlds that are larger than it. I think Minecraft their game is algorithmically generated, so they can have an indefinite openness. But you know, the interesting thing about GTA 5 is that I didn't realize until I got the game is that there's a companion app. And the companion app runs on iOS software on either your iPhone or your iPad, and it's called iFruit. And through that companion app, you can customize your ride. There's a dog in the game named Chop, and you can take care of that dog a la Tamagotchi, as you had mentioned, feed it, water it, take it for walks. And the dog's mood in the app transfers over to his mood in the game, in the full game itself.
Sounds like a lot of work, though.
It is.
Yeah.
It is kind of...
It sounds like a lot of work.
It's kind of a scam now, because I feel obligated
to... That app costs money, does it?
No, it's a free app.
Okay.
It's a free app. But I feel now obligated to continue to keep up his mood in the mini game.
You can't abandon your pets now.
Yeah. See, it's kind of a scam. But anyway, I've been playing with that. It's a great game so far. We'll talk more about that later. But Dwayne, how about yourself? What have you been playing with recently?
Recently, I've been playing with the iPhone 5S. We have a bunch of them in the office, and they are pretty interesting. I would say that where it comes to the normal iPhone 5, you wouldn't think that there's a big difference unless you touched or played with the black one.
Interesting.
The black iPhone 5S, the seemingly enameled space gray sides are... They make the phone feel different in your hand.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to say, I do enjoy that feeling. It's a good one.
Yeah, it felt lighter to me. I've played around with one a little bit, too. Definitely lighter than the...
It felt heavier to me, actually.
Really?
It made the battery maybe more capacity, something. I don't know. But it felt a little heavier in the hand to me. But that's a good thing, because I did not like the lightness of the iPhone 5. That said, for a certain thing we're doing at work, we had to go find a new iPhone 5. And you can't get one in Apple, so we had to go to Best Buy to get one. And it was a funny story. They're like, are you sure you don't want the 5C? Because it's technically a better phone than the iPhone 5. Yeah, it's interesting. The world is strange. We now call the iPhone 5 the iPhone Limited Edition.
Right.
My office, because only that and like the iPad 3 are like the two limited edition devices that Apple's made in the last several years. Being on the market as the primary device for less than a calendar year. I'm sad to say, and also somewhat weird and happy to say, that I own both of those devices. So it's kind of just a strange bag. But the iPhone 5, smooth. I definitely don't feel some of the sluggishness I've seen with A6 processors on the iPhone 5. Like when I'm on the iPhone 5 and I'm in iOS 7, it's not fast. It's adequate, but it feels like you're not getting the whole experience. Obviously, the 7 is a better experience for that. The A7, rather, is a better experience for that. And that's really what's drawing me. I dig the phone. I think it's all right. It's not like the mind-bending change you would expect.
Sure.
But that's also fine because it's an iterative process. Now, iBeacon is fantastic, and the implications for developers are really huge. It used to be, like in 2011, if you went to South by Southwest, you were surrounded by people who were like, yeah, we're going to use GPS to do this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah.
In fact, by the end of that conference, everyone's battery would be dead. This is not the case with iBeacon, which allows you to do a lot of that functionality.
Because it's low-power Bluetooth, isn't that right?
It's utilizing the low-energy Bluetooth to get a lot done. You can turn a person into a veritable social hotspot, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And that's cool. So, iPhone 5S, I've been checking it out. I haven't played so much with the 5C, but I'll get into that, and I'll figure out which one I'm going to get next.
And you also wanted to mention the Indiegogo project that you're funding.
Yeah, I got behind a project called Piper. I don't want to say too much about it because,
sure,
you know, obviously it's not going to be available for some time. But what it really is it's a home information system. It allows me to do things like check in on my house and, like, watch video. I can pan a camera around, all that stuff, from one device, from my phone. And then I can also do other things, like do things like check the humidity of my house or the temperature of my house, and set different devices to behave. So if I have a humidifier on a Z-Wave controller, Piper will go so far as to say, okay, the humidity has hit 45%. I'm going to turn that humidifier off. And that's what's so cool about it.
Hmm.
So
I'm sad I missed it.
I'm excited to see what's up. And the reason I decided to go for it was because once it's all set up and it's all out there and it's retail, it's going to have a monthly expense. Maybe it's $5, maybe it's $12. I don't really know. But if I backed it as Indiegogo, I don't have that expense. So that's kind of one of the reasons why I got behind it.
Hmm. Home connectivity. Well, maybe we'll hear a little bit more about that later.
And there's one more thing I was playing with. Basically, last night, I don't know if you guys have seen the Bill Murray movie Stripes, but it's a classic.
Love it.
And there's a urban assault vehicle in stripes.
Hell yeah.
I was in that vehicle yesterday.
You were not.
I was.
Get the hell out. How did that how did that come to happen?
A gentleman in Boulder, Denver owns the vehicle. He bought it at auction.
Wow.
Converted it into a party bus so it doesn't have guns in it anymore. And we took it to see the Red Sox Rockies game. And they play stripes in it as like the in-flight entertainment, so to speak.
Wasn't that essentially like a Winnebago?
It was GMC's only mobile home.
Oh,
in the 80s. And it's an amazing vehicle. It's got a lot of power. It's got like a weird stadium seating situation in the front. And it's pretty cool. But yeah, I was in that movie. I was in that, not in the movie. I was in that vehicle, and it was nice piece of sort of like Bill Murray legend to be a part of. So
that's kind of
how I spent my Tuesday night.
Sweet. Tosin, you had a brush with the movie greatness recently, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I had the pleasure of being able to check out LucasArts at their Letterman Digital Arts Center in San Francisco. And so it was really awesome experience. As you know, I'm a huge Star Wars, but also movie fan. And Lucasfilm, Industrial Light and Magic have done so much for the industry, be it technology as well as just, you know, production. So I got to see I shared a few photos with the group here of some of the lobby stuff, but I also got to go behind the scenes and see a lot of the really cool stuff. Some things that I saw along the way was Han Solo in Carbonite, but I also saw right next to him Jar Jar Binks in Carbonite.
Thank God.
I wish.
Pretty amazing. Amazing to know they commissioned that. If you remember from, I believe it's Ghostbusters 2, uh-huh. There's this full-length statue of,
by the way.
Yes, also another Bill Murray. Full-length statue of Viggo, or a painting of Viggo. That was also there. Basically, every single like inch of this place is lined with just
geek lore.
Yeah, geek lore, paintings, photos, actual design, you know, E.T., just all sorts of really cool and unique stuff, and it's just a fantastic facility, and utmost pleasure to be there and see, you know, what has happened in the past and where we're looking towards the future. So I think we've still got tons of awesome stuff to come from these organizations, and I cannot wait.
I'm very jealous. I've always wanted to visit that campus. This is the campus on the Presidio in San Francisco, right?
Yeah. Beautiful view of the Golden Gate Bridge, which I had never seen before never seen close up until today. So I also knocked that one out, too.
Very nice. Very nice. All right. Well, let's get into some headlines. As we talked about before, Grand Theft Auto. Last week, we talked about Grand Theft Auto hitting $800 million in sales in the first 24 hours. Since then, like, I think it was a day or two later, they crossed the $1 billion mark, which is an extraordinary success story. By comparison, Activision's Call of Duty Black Ops 2 hit $500 million in day one sales, which at the time made it the biggest entertainment launch in history. This one has topped that, and that is, just to put it in perspective, it's not just the biggest entertainment launch in video games. We're talking about all media entirely. Books bigger than the Harry Potter series, any Harry Potter books, bigger than any motion picture, bigger than any James Cameron movie, bigger than any media ever. GTA 5 beat those records. And, you know, when something like this happens, like, I always have to ask the question, is this indicative of a new trend in gaming, or is this just reflective of the popularity of GTA, period?
It's not. It's a reflection of media consumption. Who's willing to spend what? More people will probably have seen Harry Potter in the end, but frankly, they're not going to be as immersed as those who are focused on GTA. They're not going to spend GTA money. It's that age-old question of market share versus market immersion, or like profitability per user. That the one that Apple touts, yeah. like, hey, we may not have the most phones out there, but we certainly have the most like active users, users buying things. The amount of margin we make per user is a big deal. And GTA, Rockstar, is able to say that definitively, as are so many games when you look at the entertainment industry as a whole. These are engagements that are meaningful and that between Blizzard, Rockstar, the guys at Call of Duty and Modern Warfare, I mean, these are big deals. They're getting a significantly smaller percentage of users than our moviegoers to engage a significant more amount of time. And that's really where the monetization is. How much time can you get a user to donate to what you're doing? And this is where we begin to see the importance of not advertising to drive media, as is the case on the web, but great, fantastic, magnetic content to drive media.
Yeah, and you know what? It really speaks to itself for, you know, what Rockstar has been able to do in terms of in terms of world building and really producing a draw for a lot of fans. Because if you think about this, remember, this is a game that's coming out to consoles that I know a lot of people have, but a lot of people are probably – there's probably a good number of people who are holding out for brand new consoles, right? Mm-hmm. So if you look at the numbers that they were still able to produce – since Grand Theft Auto, I believe,
this audience
is going to be
is very engaged in that information, right? This audience is very focused on the fact that, hey, this is the same audience that would say, I'm not going to buy a phone today because I know a phone's coming out tomorrow. And they're still buying this game because the content is stronger than the hardware, which is difficult for geeks. That's a difficult conundrum for geeks. That's the equivalent of getting on the subway and knowing you're on a local and deciding to get off and wait for the express. These guys are staying on the local. They're like, hey, man, it's here now, and I need to be a part of it because the content is so compelling.
I just want to make a point of what you said about the world building, Rockstar's feat of world building, Tosin. Having played this game for like a week, it's phenomenal what, you know, you fully get an understanding of the incredible effort that they've done in world building. Like, when you've got every surface detail in GTA 5 is fleshed out. There's advertising, you know, in-game made-up advertising everywhere. There are hours and hours and hours of content on the radio, stuff on television that you could just sit down and watch the in-game TVs for hours. And now movies. There are theaters that you can go to and watch movies in the cinema within the game as well. And all
so
that content has to be
is
made.
Is the game itself enough of a platform so that PS3 and Xbox and all these other things, they're no longer the platform? Is the game itself enough of a platform for media consumption that users are just going to log into whatever they can to get to GTA 3 and make use of that for their entertainment? Like, that's where they're going. I mean, I'm sorry, not 3, 5. GTA 5 is going to be around for a long time. It's very conceivable that they continue to world build here, add new content, push content to it intelligently so that the movies inside change, the radio gets more like subject matter. And that's a big deal.
Yeah, and you can play entire mini games. You can play games like tennis and triathlon and motorboating. And all of these things, I mean, it's like, it's amazing where we've come from, where Pong was a tennis analog, and that was the state of the art of video games, and now a full blown tennis game is a mini game inside of this huge, you know, world built super universe. Yes, thank you. So it's just phenomenal. Props to Rockstar, and I'm hoping that this is creates sort of a renaissance in games and inspires developers to push themselves further to create games like this, more games like this. Okay, so moving on. Last week we talked with VentureBeat's Tom Cheridar about Pandora, and I think Dwayne, I believe you took the position that you felt that Apple was going to change Pandora's fate for the negative.
No, that's not my position at all. My position is that Apple is stepping into Pandora's wheelhouse and has the ability over time to remove Pandora from being a monopoly in the internet radio space.
Well, it's certainly looking like it's coming to pass. This week, Pandora's usership fell 10% on the release of Apple's new iTunes radio service. Pandora founder Tim Westergren said, "We believe iTunes Radio will have a modest impact." That was before these new statistics. So 10% is more than just a modest impact, I think. And we'll see how...
That is incredibly impactful.
Yeah, yeah.
10% of 70 million people is 7 million people.
Yeah.
7 million people. It takes 6 weeks for someone to count from 1 to a million.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's 42 weeks of just counting. Not going to work. Not eating. Just counting. That's how big that number is. We use numbers like billion and million really easily in our current culture. And the idea that like 7 million people have left the usership of a user base that you've grown over the course of several years. I think Pandora became super, like, you know, 2008, they became an app on the iPhone.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed up on like your computer in 2006. So for 7 years, you've grown at the rate of average rate of 10 million people a year. And in 1 week, you've lost almost 10 million people.
I want to
get Tom on next week.
I think this is more their shares. So I'm not sure this is necessarily the number of people, but that's more their shares. And that's assuming that these users aren't using multiple things, right? So it may not be exactly like that. But I will say that just having on my iPhone, just having music right there integrated, I came very close a couple times during the office, while in the office, while like thinking about what should I listen to, just clicking on that and be like, huh, let me try Apple Radio because it's right here at my fingertips.
Right.
It's just that easy.
The bigger question is, as we see the data that shows that first-time smartphone buyers are pretty ambivalent, but that second-time smartphone buyers tend to move toward iOS, you begin to wonder if you're a person like Tosin, you're sitting in front of your computer, you've got iTunes open, you've updated it, and iTunes Radio is present and available.
Yep.
And then you get on your phone, and it's a Samsung, and iTunes Radio isn't there, but you know that you like the service, you like how it works, and you're ready to get another phone. Are you not going to look toward Apple's phones to say, you know what, my iPhone does everything my Droid does, except my Droid doesn't have – my Android, not my Droid. I'm sorry. My Android doesn't have iTunes Radio, so maybe I should look into that because I spent this time on my computer hooking up my stations, getting them to know me. I've purchased music through Apple before, so it understands what I like and what I want. So, you know, these stations are really helpful to me. And then suddenly you're moving toward the Apple sphere. Apple's Outlook looked very good today. It's hanging out at 490. That's up significantly from the last time I looked at it, which was in the 460s, and certainly up from the September 10th event. So what we're seeing is possibly a shift. I haven't seen Pandora stock today, but I think we're going to take a look and we're going to see where it's sitting.
Well,
am I right?
And what's more too, if you are a new Apple, a new iPhone user, you've never, had streaming radio before, you're just not going to sign up. You're just not going to add Pandora as an app because iTunes Radio is right there on your phone installed natively.
And that's where I think we have a slight disagreement, because the radio world, in the traditional sense of radio, you move from place to place. you keep on going. They're all, if you're in a big market like LA, like you are, there are at least two top 40 stations. There are at least two country stations, and you're going to move back and forth. So that one or two times that you're like, man, Pandora's annoying, I'm going to go to iTunes Radio. Or you're like, man, iTunes is annoying, I'm going to go to Pandora. That still happens. So I think at least in the short term, people are going to say, let me check out the other one just to see what's up.
Well, I think people are in general lazy when it comes to their devices. Like if something's already there, they're less likely to go seek out something to.
But it's so it. It's just so the barrier to entry. I'm saying so easy. Just like turning your dial on the radio, going to your next preset.
Sure.
It's that simple.
Sure. Not, I pay for the Spotify service myself, and what I like about that is the ability to choose songs. But I'm also glad that Spotify also has a radio function similar to Pandora and iTunes Radio, where I just push a radio button and it'll populate songs that are similar to the songs that I'm already listening to. So for me, like, there's no reason for me to switch to either of these other services.
Yeah, and then but then again, there's the whole idea that it's a switch.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily a switch unless you find that you're so perfectly dialed into Spotify that it's a crazy barrier for you to even think about using another service, you know.
Yeah.
By the way, Pandora's stock spiked at about 1 o'clock this afternoon and tapered off, but it has been in steady growth. Went up, it looks like, 4% today. So they're not in a position where Wall Street is looking at them as a pain point. This is Wednesday, the 25th of September.
Last week, we talked about the launch of the 5S and in particular, Touch ID, one of the new fingerprint sensing security technology. This week, the Chaos Computer Club claims to be able to bypass that with a photo of the original user's fingerprint. And how they say that they've done that is that first, the fingerprint of the enrolled user is photographed with 2400 DPI resolution. The image is cleaned up, inverted, and laser printed with a 1200 DPI onto a transparent sheet with a thick toner setting. And then wood glue is smeared onto the pattern created by the toner onto the transparent sheet. After it cures, a thin latex sheet is lifted from the sheet, breathed on to make it a tiny bit moist, and placed onto the sensor to unlock the phone. And they state that this specific technique isn't new.
Don't help. And all this other stuff in order to make this happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's you know, and the guy who participated in this hack had this to say about that particular hack. He's about Touch ID security in general. He says, "Yes, Touch ID has flaws, and yes, it's possible to exploit those flaws and unlock an iPhone. But the reality is, these flaws are not something that the average consumer should worry about. Why? Because exploiting them was anything but trivial." Hacking Touch ID relies on a combination of skills, existing academic research, and the patience of a crime scene technician. So, I mean, it's going to take a lot. This was basically just a proof of concept, just to see if they can break this security, and they were able to do it.
Yeah, and boy, did the media go nuts.
Yeah.
But guys, if you think about it, though, we've been talking about Prism. We've been talking about perhaps backdoors to get into encrypted iPhones. Talking about all that stuff, if you are in the government and you've gotten access to someone's Touch ID unlockable iPhone, then this process, as laborious as it seems, as much as I made fun of it about the resurrection of Christ and all that stuff, it's not difficult for you to pull off if you have access to the person's fingerprint and they're unwilling. With a password, you have to either crack it or you have to extract it. And the law says you can't tell someone to give you their password. It's actually the Fifth Amendment self-incrimination. You can't tell somebody, hey, you need to give us your password to get into this computer so we can do whatever. You can't do that. But with extraordinary types of measures, you can basically fingerprint everybody. You fingerprint them, you can go and, you know, it may take you a day, but you'll get into that phone and see what it is they're doing. So there are some implications here. It's just that for the average user, it's not a big deal if you're not going to get taken or, you know, run down by the NSA or whatever. But more important from all of that, Apple claims that most users, for a little bit more than 50%, are not using any kind of security on their devices. The fact that this is such an easy way to implement security, the passcode doesn't do anything, that makes their devices, you know, 50%+ more secure overall. So then you get to this iBeacon thing, and if restaurants or other outside of the home businesses are going to ask for payment, this makes the payment option really viable. Just like with the Find Your Friends app on an iPhone or an iPad, where you can only make it work out of the box by putting in your passcode.
Right.
By having a passcode enabled on your actual system level device, of the device. This can become a thing here, and that's impressive. That can mean a shift. So there's something to this. It's we still have to look into it, but there's something here.
For sure. And even the guy who cracked the thing even said, you know, he wants this to be really a call to Apple to take the fact that this has been cracked and use it to ensure that future products and services are designed with increased biometric security in consideration. And he even calls for Apple to do like a two-step authentication process with the fingerprint and something else.
Well, I think they currently do a little bit of that with the passcode for specific information. So requiring not just the fingerprint but also the passcode for specific details on the device, or at least it should be enabled. I mean, I think one of the big takeaways right here is, you know, of course, as Dwayne eloquently put it, you know, this does give users some security, but as an everyday user, you should still, you know, go the extra mile and be aware of what you're doing with your devices, where you're keeping them, and, you know, as throughout your life, given the risks in the world, and this is not just with your phone, but with all aspects of your identity, it's important that you keep those in mind.
All right, let's take a moment here to talk about our sponsor, Audible.com, the world's leading provider of digital spoken word entertainment on the internet with over 100,000 titles. For the listeners of the Drill Down podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you a chance to check out their service. And the book I'm going to recommend this week is Dr. Sleep, a novel by Stephen King. Stephen King returns to the characters and territory of one of his most popular novels ever, The Shining, in this instantly riveting novel about the now middle-aged Dan Torrance, who is the boy protagonist of The Shining, and the very special 12-year-old girl he must save from a tribe of murderous paranormals. On the highways across America, a tribe of people called the True Knot travel in search of sustenance. They look harmless, mostly old, lots of polyester, and married to their RVs. But as Dan Torrance knows and the spunky 12-year-old Abra Stone learns, the True Knot are quasi-immortal, living off the steam that children with The Shining produce when they are slowly tortured to death. This is a new, basically the sequel to The Shining that Stephen King has written. Early reviews of it say that it's a lot of, it's not quite as intense as The Shining and maybe not as scary overall. It's worth checking out because it's, if you like The Shining, you might like this story too.
Well, I'm glad they're doing it. A little bit of trivia: the hotel that the outside of the hotel that's used in The Shining is actually here in Colorado. It's in a place called Estes Park that is unfortunately inaccessible because of the recent flooding that's happened out here.
Uh-huh.
But when you go to the Stanley Hotel, it's very clear where you are. And I've been there, obviously, because I like The Shining and I'm a movie buff, or that kind of thing. But it's exciting to think about. It's one of those things where you go there trying to immerse yourself in the film.
So it's kind of cool that, like, there's going to be more, right? Like, we always like more, and we're very lucky to be able to have Stephen King being around for a book that's really quite old. He was on NPR. The reporter said, hey, you know, people – there's mixed reviews about the quality, longevity of your work. And he's like, you know what?
And the reason why is because you write so much.
Yeah.
You know what? I understand that I'm not going to be around forever. There's a lot in here. And I want to be as productive as I can be while I do it. And that is something that I really – that moved me. So, you know, you gotta check out these books while the author's around. Just, you know, be a part of that aspect of our culture, which is really what's so exciting.
Yeah, I honestly don't know how he does it. He's incredibly – one of the most prolific authors I've ever known.
He makes me look like a pussy.
Yeah. In any case, to download that free audiobook or any one of Audible's other 100,000-plus titles, go to audibletrial.com/thedrilldown. Again, that's audibletrial.com/thedrilldown for that free audiobook. Even if you don't like the Audible service, you can cancel it, and you still get to keep Dr. Sleep. We're going to take a little break here and listen to some music, and when we return, new product updates from Apple, Microsoft, and Amazon, and a gaming game changer from Valve. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom, the roundtable podcast where we take a look at the best in tech and on the web and how it affects us. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Anafowakin. So let's talk about some product updates here. Apple TV received a huge software update this week with version 6.0. And with that brings with it iTunes Radio, AirPlay from iCloud, iCloud Photos and Videos, which replaces PhotoStream, iTunes Music Store, and Conference Room Mode. And AirPlay from iCloud, we sort of talked about a little bit before this launch came out, which this feature mirrors Google's Chromecast. And once you enable it, it allows you to use your iOS device to play videos from iTunes in the cloud, which means the content is streamed directly to Apple TV rather than your iOS device, which reduces local bandwidth in half, and allows you to also, you know, be able to play your content at someone else's house from their Apple TV. I was going to ask you, Dwayne, do you have Apple TV?
I do.
Did you get this update, this version 6 update?
I have not had a chance to get the version 6 update. My biggest happy moment with Apple TV of late has been the streaming, the AirPlaying of the Amazon instant streaming app, and the instant video app. And I've got to say that it obviated the use of my Chromecast instantly. And it made it so that now I feel like I'm no longer missing a big chunk of my TV experience from the Apple TV, because I can send my iPad's HD screen. It also made it so that, like, I will probably never buy an iTunes video ever, because Amazon so easily plays on my Apple TV. I may be an Apple guy when it comes to hardware.
Yeah.
But I buy every bit of music from Amazon. I spend my money on Pandora when it comes to getting that situation. And the video that I purchase in HD comes from Amazon, and it looks great. I tend to buy anime.
That's so awesome.
Like the X-Men anime and stuff like that.
Uh-huh.
So, and I get it on Amazon because I can play it on a Windows computer or an OS X computer. I can play it on an iOS device, or I can play it on an Android device. It doesn't actually matter.
It's platform agnostic.
Exactly. Whereas if I buy from iTunes, I'm really tied to that platform. Now, is it easier to buy from iTunes? Yeah, I would say that the ease of use is definitely there. But for just like the ease of the portability, should I want to move to another platform, my content persists, and that's key.
I still have not yet jumped into buying a standalone set-top device because I cannot decide between Apple TV, the Chromecast, or the Roku. I'm still sort of up in the air about that.
Yeah, I thought that I would probably get an Apple TV at some point just because of the positives I've heard. There were some issues in earlier releases with having to, you know, stick to strict Apple formats and converting all your existing media. Mm-hmm. But I think right now the Chromecast is just really tight that I don't know if I have an immediate need. I'd like to see what else the Apple has up its sleeve in terms of the Apple TV, because for some reason, I don't know, it just feels like it just doesn't have that innovation there yet. It seems like like they're holding back something, or they're trying, or I hope they're trying to achieve something, and it's just, yeah, I can't wait.
Microsoft announced a revamped line of Surface tablets this week. The Surface 2, the successor to the Surface RT, starts at $449 for the 32-gig version, and the Surface Pro 2, running a fourth-generation Intel, will start at $899 for a 64-gig version. The new Surface 2, Surface Pro 2 promises significantly better battery life. Microsoft says 60%. They'll also sell a power cover for both tablets, which further extends the battery life, but it'll be $200 and won't be available till sometime next year. The type cover and touch cover keyboard accessories have been upgraded with features including backlit keys for using in the dark. Microsoft will also sell a docking station for $200, available sometime early next year.
Why don't they just sell a laptop?
Well, like, they're still into the whole sort of hybrid thing. They want to like encourage this hybrid lifestyle of, you know, keyboard if you want it and tablet.
The only hybrids that work well are the automobiles now. Like, I feel like it's all about, it's like, it just reminds me of that phase. Remember that phase when we had the DVD player on one side of the device and the VHS player on the other?
Or the television set that had
the VHS player built into it. And that kind of integration, I mean, I like integration. We all do. I mean, whatever. But that kind of middling focus is problematic. It's not going to do one thing completely well. A fourth generation Intel chip is a great thing, but the Surface original, the tablets didn't have the best battery life. The covers didn't sleep the device. Like, there's a paradigm of how this stuff is done, and they didn't obey it because they were like, oh, we're going to be something different. I applaud originality, but it didn't deliver. And I hope with the Surface 2 they deliver, but given the nearly billion dollar write down on the original Surface, I'm not convinced that this second time around is all there. They want to go original, bring back the Courier.
Oh, right. That was everyone sort of responded well to that concept, and then it just disappeared.
Evaporated.
You know what I thought was really interesting about the Surface stuff is something that got very little press. Is they created a cover for the Surface that has a interface, a specialty interface for mixing music. Instead of a QWERTY keyboard, it's got sliders for volume sliders and a touchpad, like a chaos pad, where you have samples that you can touch. And it's a sort of a limited edition thing, and the interesting about that is that the potential is there for creating all these sort of custom covers that do unique things that extend the usability of the Surface. But anyway. There we go. That's the Surface, the new Surface Pro and Surface Pro.
Hey, we got to wish them luck because they need to disrupt this space. I don't know what the next iPad's going to look like, but I think the world needs a new tablet.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of, Amazon introduced two new Fire Tablet HDX models.
229.
Yep, 229 for the 7-inch model, 16 gig, and 329 for the LTE-enabled WWAN version. They both have a brand new high-resolution screens, that's the HDX, and they're running an updated Snapdragon 800 quad-core processor at 2 gigs. They're considerably thinner than the original Fire models. Amazon's also launching an updated OS called Fire OS with improved enterprise compatibility. Here's an interesting thing. Amazon has added Mayday, a 24/7 customer support solution that allows you to ping Amazon support people. So essentially you hit the little Mayday button and remote support folks appear in a little video window and can annotate your screen with arrows and even touch UI items.
This Bezos guy is just so damned clever.
I know,
like,
right?
It's just such common sense. It's not focused on like, oh, it's got to look like this or whatever. I mean, it's not ugly. Yeah. I mean, Amazon could be a bit more smooth, but whatever. I use it every day and I love it. My girlfriend laments that my money is almost wholly spent on his website. But I would say that this kind of innovation is so straightforward, so lacking in a need for visual overhead that is just there in your face. This is how we're going to do it.
Yep.
That makes it, it makes it so it's like they're not worried about what paradigm we're using or what creative direction should we go in.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Can we get it to work? How quickly can I be in your face to tell you how to fix it? Can I put an arrow in your screen to tell you to point somewhere? That's brilliant.
It's free. And as long as you're online, you can access the service anytime. You know that you're doing well, that you've created a innovation in the marketplace when you look at something and you go, why isn't the competition doing something like this?
Well, how come this hasn't been there before?
Right.
That was the whole iPod revolution, right? Mm-hmm. How come we couldn't do this before? How come nobody thought about it this easily? And that's what's up.
So those are the new Kindle Fires. Jessica Lesson reports that smart thermostat maker Nest Labs has been developing a smoke detector that could go on sale as soon as later this year. All Things D reports that the name of the product is going to be Protect. The device will be the technology company's latest Trojan horse into your home, which wants to make as easy to control as a computer or smartphone. Think of it as the next node in the home network that Nest is building device by device with the original thermostat as the hub.
What's Nest data storage about? Like, can you imagine the amount of, like, data on, like, home heating systems they have?
Yeah.
Like, they could probably recognize what burner you have for your gas or your oil by the way that they have to regulate. You know? Like, the amount of the secondary nature of their data to manufacturers, to homemakers.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. That's an excellent point, Dwayne. And you know, it's funny because we were talking about the Indiegogo project that you had mentioned before, Piper. This reminds me a lot of that, but it's like this is
right, Piper is focused more on being able to regulate devices based on what it senses as the temperature.
Yeah.
So Piper doesn't control a thermostat, but it just tells you what your heat is, the temperature, your humidity, things like that. So it can work very much in compatibility with a Nest device. I'm sure later on they might think about getting into that. But right now there are several Z-Wave type thermostats. They're just not Nest. So
but now you get to see a peek a little bit at Nest's bigger picture. You know, because it was easy to see. Well, they made a thermostat. What's next? But now we see a thermostat and now a smoke detector. You can envision like several other home automation products that they can like.
Well, if you're Samsung, you need to chase down Nest and snap it up.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that. Your Samsung makes washing machines. They have a Wi-Fi washer and dryer set. They make refrigerators. They make all this stuff in your house. And if they can't see the potential of owning that smart system and grabbing the talent that is behind Nest's crazy intuitive interface and using those guys in their smart home systems.
Don't forget, these are the guys that developed the iPod.
They worked on the iPod. That's true. They're not the only people who developed the iPod, but they were definitely instrumental in the iPod's interface creation. But I think they've departed from that in a good way. Right, yeah. The iPod is a great feather in their cap.
Sure,
but Nest is wholly different, and they've differentiated. It wouldn't be like Samsung just trying to copy Apple in this space, because it's not. It's a whole space they can do. And again, Samsung needs to jump in there and say, you know what? I'm not going to call this the WND5540 washing machine. I'm going to call this the Galaxy S washer and dryer set. I'm going to call this the Galaxy S TV. I'm going to call this the Galaxy S thermostat. I'm going to call this the Galaxy S refrigerator.
I think they should just snatch you up too. While they're
like, there's no reason why they can't unify brands in such a manner as to help people understand. You thought Apple had an ecosystem?
Yeah.
Wait till I buy a Hyundai, motherfuckers. Like, that's how they need to focus. You know, get that focus. Because they have incredible products.
Yeah.
And if they could just use them, use these powers to unite them like Voltron and just be a crazy large robot made of millions of lines of awesome, they're going to be in everybody's home.
Can I quote you? Because that is awesome. I definitely agree there. Like, that would be seriously monumental if Samsung – I think Samsung would join really the big two, you know, Google and Apple if they started doing stuff like that.
Yeah, and you know what the best part about all that is that Google would not necessarily look at Samsung as a competitor, because Samsung's running on their system, because Samsung is, you know, it's more like a competitive partner. It's like, hey, you guys are making phones, we're making phones, we're maybe competing in that space, but the fact of the matter is we're being that data partner that allows you to get all this stuff done, you know, inside on your devices. And we're gonna support that, because you're gonna be a leading indicator of what we're capable of. There's a partnership there. It's the same partnership that people like John Gruber wish Google had with Apple.
Right.
Right. It's possible with Samsung, because Samsung's acquiesced and said, "Yeah, I made my own little operating system for smartphones, but really, I'm just using Android. My premier devices are using Android. My Note 2, my Note 3, my S4, my S3. They're all there. So." Yeah, I think that's the future for them.
Interesting. Well, let's move on here. Last week, we discussed Valve Software CEO Gabe Newell's comments at a recent Linux convention that the future of gaming is Linux. And while he was cryptic about the reasoning for the opinion, he hinted that more would be revealed soon. This week, the wait is over. Valve has revealed Steam OS, its own operating system based on Linux, designed for living room gaming PCs. It's the first step toward Valve's Steam Box, its vision for an open video game console. It combines Steam's digital distribution platform with a user interface designed for TVs, all on top of the Linux platform. Valve says it'll be available soon as a free standalone operating system for living room machines. Valve says that major game developers are already on board with Linux and will be building AAA game titles that will run natively on SteamOS in 2014. I think that's an achievement that only Valve could have pulled off, is getting those major game developers on board with Linux. SteamOS boxes will also have a workaround for the huge existing library of Windows games in home streaming. And this technology is not unlike the NVIDIA Shield and more like a local version of OnLive or Gaikai, Sony's system. It'll include a method for wirelessly streaming games from your existing gaming computer to your TV, which Valve says will also come to the regular Steam client at some point in the future. Also coming to both Steam and SteamOS, streaming video and music services. Valve says that they're working with many of the media services we know and love. Man, they're really stepping up the game.
They've been moving toward an online services role in the last several years. Steam is, you know, phenomenally successful.
Yeah.
And by being a platform, they see the power in that, you know?
Yep.
Could you imagine what would happen if Valve were to link up with a Twitter or a Facebook and allow that kind of, like, global level of sharing? Like, my Fitbit talks to my Twitter account and says, hey, this is how much I've done, whatever, whatever. Imagine if your achievements were just popping up on Twitter. Like, cool achievements, not like how many steps you've taken.
Sure.
But, like, you've unlocked some awesome shit, not on Foursquare, but in, like, the greatest game that ever, you know what I mean? Like,
sort of like gamifying life is what you're suggesting?
You could do it in many ways. You could gamify, but I'm just saying, like, let's forget about gamifying life and the quantified self physicality. Let's talk about it in terms of your online life and the real fun you have when you're in Portal and you get past that portal. If you're sitting there and you've got a friend who's competing with you on that front, you know, now it's out there. It's in the Library of Congress that you beat them to it.
Yeah, some indie games do have that included as well that are available on Steam. So,
and if Valve throws that like iOS, like just system wide, just make an API that all the games that run on your systems native to Steam can tap into, then how much engagement does Valve suddenly become responsible for, and how much more valuable does that make the company? I don't know. Tosin, I'm sorry. You were saying something.
Oh, no. I was just saying in terms of like the box, it will be really interesting to see what happens with it in the future, in the forefront, and how much they – and we already discussed part of this, I believe, last week. But how much weight – Valve has a lot of weight to throw around.
Yeah.
But the question is what do the majority of the people paying the money, like are they going to – go with a dedicated machine like this, or are they going to stick to one of the, you know, to the existence of the current console generation? And by current console, I mean, you know, new PlayStation, new Xbox, you know, Nintendo to a lesser
degree. Does Valve join Generation 8? Nintendo's Wii U not getting the kinds of play from game makers.
Yeah.
Madden 25 is not on the Wii U, but it is on the Wii. Right? They're like, we're just not going to support the Wii U. Sorry, we love Nintendo, but the Wii U is not a console. We're going to make Madden 25. 25 years of football game experience is not going to the latest generation Nintendo device. But that doesn't mean there's not room for the Steam Box to show up and be that third console in the space. Because we all know that if they're going to compete on the graphics level...
Mm-hmm.
And they're going to compete on the title level, then they're going to compete powerfully.
Well, you know, the Steam OS wasn't the only announcement Valve had to make this week, and it's in fact not the only announcement they're going to make. They made another announcement today that beginning in 2014, there will be multiple Steam OS machines to choose from made by different manufacturers. They weren't clear on what manufacturers they're working with or what the Steam Box will look like. But it's confirmed that they've created their own box optimized specifically for Steam OS, and they're going to be shipping 300 of them to Steam users who sign up for a limited beta program by October 25th. They said there'll be several Steam Box prototypes with an array of specifications, price, and performance, all of which will be freely hackable by their users. You can even install another operating system on the boxes.
You realize what they're doing. They've basically become Android. They're like, I've got my Steam Nexus device.
Yeah.
And Samsung and HTC and everybody and their mother are free to create their own device. And just like all those devices, you can root it and you can put whatever the hell you want on it.
Yep. Yep.
They're becoming Android. And that's powerful. Now imagine if you had a Google TV device, an Apple TV device, a Roku device. That was powerful enough to play Steam games. What would that do to the console makers who are trying to be across everything? That would disrupt the market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Especially if it had some sort of... the device itself wouldn't have to be very powerful. As we've already seen with the OnLive streaming devices, it could just stream games from another system in your house or from central servers somewhere. And it could just be sort of like the gateway to accessing those games. You're right, absolutely right. Using the Steam distribution system.
Hey, man, it's a gamer's world. We just live in it.
They've got one more announcement, which is scheduled for this Friday, which is unfortunately, it's when the drill down will be released, but we're recording this on a Wednesday. So I'm sure whatever their third announcement is, we're going to be talking about in the next episode of the drill down. We're going to take one last break. And when we come back, a farewell to a Nintendo legend and our drill down video of the week. So take a listen to this and come on back. If you're just joining us, you're listening to The Drill Down on Geeks of Doom. I'm Andy Sarcini. I'm here with Dwayne DeFreitas and Tosin Onofawakan. Hiroshi Yamauchi, the Japanese businessman credited with transforming Nintendo into a world-leading video games company, has died this week at the age of 85. Mr. Yamauchi ran the firm for 53 years, from 1949 to 2002, and was its second largest shareholder at the time of his death. But what's significant is what he did during that time. During that time, he took what was a small-time collectible trading card company and built it into one of the most recognizable and successful video game brands today. He spearheaded Nintendo as they moved into the arcade business with such hits as Donkey Kong and Super Mario Brothers. He was the president of Nintendo during the NES, the SNES, the N64, and the GameCube. Those first two games were transformative pieces of electronic entertainment. So hats off to Hiroshi Yamauchi.
Guys, this guy's a big deal. And, yeah. I just want to underscore some aspects of this man's ability to move the ball forward. Nintendo was a gaming company. They sold card games.
Sure.
Card games after the war, card games that were cheap enough for people to buy. When the technology came around, he noticed that, hey, people might play on these things. Let's try these things out. And he put the devices in the stores, and they flew off the shelves. He was not a gamer himself when it came to video games. He was a man, from my research and from listening to All Things Considered and some other things like mm-hmm. that. He would look at a game being played by other people for about 5 minutes and decide whether or not it needed work, it was ready to go, it would be a mediocre hit or a big hit, or it needed to go back to the drawing board. That's what he did. He looked at a game, he looked at like the Mario, like Super Mario 2, and he'd be like, that's going to be all right. I think we can put the Mario name on it. It's significantly different from the original Mario, so be it. He looked at a game like Mario 3 and be like, that's where we needed to get back to. Absolutely. Donkey Kong, whatever. And that was his like strength and power.
Yeah.
So when you wonder why Nintendo is not all about hardware, why Nintendo is not all about like having the latest processors and all that stuff, it's partly because the game experience didn't always need that. It didn't need that to be successful
yeah.
if it was a good enough game. And that's one of the things that he was focused on. So, you know, he obviously transformative. When you think of Japanese electronics, Nintendo has to come to mind. Japanese engineering, you think of Nintendo and Toyota and Sony and all these things. Nintendo's just up there. So this man, clearly a classic.
Yeah so, I agree.
Godfather Hall of Fame of technology, which we should maybe put together. We should maybe put together a Hall of Fame of geek culture that has men like this in it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, I so I currently have a Super Nintendo in my trunk. Uh-huh. And it's like a constant thing in my trunk because we sometimes play it at the office. You never know when you're going to need to play a game of Bomberman or Mario Kart. And it's just, it's really amazing to see how he shaped a generation and, mm-hmm. and you know, advanced the future in terms of technology.
That's what he did. He shaped a generation. And you know what's interesting about this generation, this the coming out of geek culture and all that stuff, is this idea that it's a cultural platform, right? And games like this, it's not that just that games like Bomberman were out there and we all know what they are. It's that we all know what they are and we lived in an age where we can share what they are and share that culture really easily. Confluence of technologies allowed that to happen. So you look at, like, you think of, like, older people. Oh, man, what a dinosaur. This guy wasn't a Gen Xer like Bill Gates or Steve Jobs. This guy right. wasn't a baby boomer, you know? Yeah. This guy was a pre-World War II dude. Yeah. And he, like Akira Kurosawa in movies, he changed the way that we look at entertainment to the yep. point where Rockstar is able to drop a get their hands on $1 billion after dropping a game that's been in development for just half a decade or less. Yep. That's like the power. That's like the scope. So like, oh yeah, cool. He was a dude. He helped Nintendo out. Great, whatever. No, I mean like, that's where we come from. That's where it comes from. So that's kind of, you know, yep. righteous to quote Bill and Ted.
Well, sorry to see him go, and yeah, I'm ready to induct him as the first Hall of Fame geek. Hall of Fame member, the Drill Down Geek Hall of Fame member, if we have such a thing.
Yeah, we're gonna have to work on that, guys.
Props to him.
Exactly.
All right, it's time for our Drill Down video of the week, and this week the video I have chosen is called Bat Dad, and what's brilliant about this is it's the link that I've got here is a YouTube video, but what it is a compilation of Vine videos, and this was a this is a dad who will occasionally and secretly, covertly put on a Batman mask and then sort of become Batman for his wife and kids at random times when they're out driving or doing random things around the house. And this is like a brilliant example of how best to use a platform like Vine, these short little blips of comedy, and just brilliantly done. So I don't know if you guys had a chance to take a look at this, but this was absolutely like the best.
Bat Dad,
the funniest highlight of the week.
Bat Dad.
Yep, his kids love it when he's Bat Dad, and it completely aggravates his wife, which is also hilarious to watch.
Yeah, it's pretty brilliant. It's cool to think that we're still able to be innovative and have fun with new technologies. So, props to him.
Absolutely. It's just like another example of that geek culture being pervasive. Like just saying, hey, look, I'm going to use this to be creative. Not that I have the time to make a full movie or anything like that, but I can do these vignettes and that matters.
All right, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of The Drill Down. I'm going to go around the table here and start with you, Dwayne. Where can we find your work online when you're not here on The Drill Down?
You can find me on twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can find everything I do at flavors.me/DwayneD. You can also see what I'm up to at gplus.to/DwayneD. And you can have a running bet as to how many iOS updates my phone will get since it still runs iOS 6 because I'm not sure about iOS 7 yet. I'm at 103 today. Let's see where we're at next week.
Updates, like app updates?
Yeah, app updates.
Yeah. If you had iOS 7, those would update automatically.
I can't even update these because they're all for iOS 7. They're like, oh, can't do it. So we're just going to see how many that turns into. I think I have 309 apps on my phone, so we'll see if it gets that high.
Yikes. Yeah, everyone is reacting like crazy in the app space. Tosin, how about yourself? Where can we find your work online when you're not on the show?
You can find me at twitter.com/toast4321, T-O-A-S-T, 4321. You can also find my other work at ircwebcast.blogspot.com.
As for myself, you can find me at MrBabyMan.com and Twitter.com and Facebook.com at MrBabyMan. If you got an idea for a story you think we should be talking about on The Drill Down, tweet us or email us at comments@thedrilldown.com. If you got a viewpoint of any of the stories we've talked about or any issue that pertains to technology, social media, or geek culture, send that story to submissions@thedrilldown.com for us to publish on the site. You can let The Drill Down podcast help you reach the targeted tech-savvy market of influencers and outliers. That is our lovely audience by writing to sales@thedrilldown.com for details. And be sure to catch us next week at the same time and location. And that's it for this episode of The Drill Down. Thanks for joining us.
By the way, really, I totally forgot this. So I was at Google's campus of the weekend, did a lot of, like, I had a friend in from Texas, so we went around and, you know, did a lot of sort of tourist valley tech stuff, went to the HP garage, all those other stuff.
Oh, nice.
I didn't realize that Google already has their, so you guys are aware Google has a lawn where they have the various Android devices, right? They have various. I didn't realize that they had the KitKat out there already.
I saw pictures of that.
Yeah, they've got the KitKat out, which is kind of cool.
They're going to do that for all 26 plus iterations of Android?
See, if Google were smart, it would have done the Spanish alphabet, which has 29 letters in it. Right? It would have been like the CH.
I would have loved to see the N-Y.
With the tilde on it, the double R. They would have been like, yeah.
I don't think there's a Spanish word that begins with ñ. Is there? I don't know. I have to look that up.
I'm sure there is. And I'm sure it's a dessert.
Yeah. No, I didn't. They have done with everyone so far, and it's pretty awesome.
Why wouldn't they? Yeah, it's a tradition now. People look forward
Although
to
I think there was with Jelly Bean, at one point, I think they may have taken it inside because someone stole like the things from the inside. The Jelly Bean.
The one thing I don't like about Kit Kat.
Yeah,
is that
it's branded?
If you're gonna brand, you should have branded Jell-O, because Jell-O is a true dessert, whereas a jelly bean is not something you eat after you eat dinner. Huh. Like if they're gonna brand it, they should have started at Jell-O and move forward. And I don't know if Kit Kat was the only K out there. I haven't done the work to figure that out, I just feel like. You know, give me a break.
Literally. Do you think that there are going to be any other branded iterations?
Absolutely, now.
Yeah, the window is open.
Yeah.
Because remember, this deal was done in like 24 hours. And literally, they just called in the marketing folks Nestle and was like, hey, do you mind if we do this? And this deal was done 24 hours. You now know that in the future, organizations are going to be coming to them. So... Like
I mean, like that's a. If you're a candy company in an age of organic hemp milk, and one of the biggest tech companies wants to get up in your grill and be like, "Hey, we want to name our stuff after you," you are behind it.
I just looked up on Answers.com for desserts that start with an X, and they say there are none. So they're gonna have a little challenge when they get to.
So clearly, what we have to do is create a candy dessert company. Right now.
Seed it. Years in advance.
I'm a business genius.
You are.
That's what we do. We create the X candy, maybe even get Marvel to support it. It tastes like whatever you need it to taste like.
Let's make the website.
A brilliant idea.
You can at least hold the domain.
Exactly. I'm saying, like, you just get in the X candy, and then, you know, by like 2035... when they get there, we'll be in good shape.